This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Tomorrow is Independence Day in America. Stephen Fleury has asked me to host the Trumpet Daily Radio Show tomorrow on America's birthday. I'm looking forward to that. And we'll be talking in that show about some of the principles that guided the nation's founding and the composition of our Constitution. In the first segment on today's show, though, I want to look at the Declaration of Independence. These days, it seems about the only thing we hear about America's founding was that it was brought about by slave owners. But I want to show how the Declaration etched into the pages of history a revolutionary concept that enabled this country to eliminate slavery and to become the freest, most inclusive, greatest land of opportunity for all its people in all of human history. We're also going to hear a report from Jeremiah Jacques about President Donald Trump's visit to North Korea this past Sunday. And we'll hear a report from Andrew Miller about how the spirit of the Obama administration continues to affect society today, specifically in how many Obama-era officials in various spy and law enforcement agencies are now influencing the public through mass media. At the end of the program, we'll look at a couple of scriptures that show how the brightest days for America and for Britain lie yet ahead. We'll begin, though, by talking about the birth of America. ...243 years ago tomorrow in Philadelphia, the members of the Continental Congress voted to dissolve the connection with Great Britain. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. These are the words Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence. And then he said this: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." In 6,000 years of human history, this was a radical idea, that all men are created equal. Nobody is born to rule over another man. And it isn't a ruler or a king or a government that gives them their rights or their freedom. It's God. And any government that tramples on those God-given rights is illegitimate. No man has the right to deprive another man of those rights because he is accountable to that other man's creator. When one man oppresses another man, he's going to have to answer to God. Jefferson wrote just days before his death on July 4th, 1826, that the U.S. was founded on the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. That idea had never formed the foundation of a nation's politics. The mass of people in all of history never experienced what he was talking about there. Every American should be inspired by this noble history. Now, where does this idea come from? That all men are created equal and that they're endowed by their Creator with the rights to life and freedom and the pursuit of happiness, rights that no man can take away. Well, President Calvin Coolidge gave a speech on July 4th in 1926, the 150th anniversary of the Declaration, and he talked about how this idea was actually grounded in the Bible. President Coolidge said, "In its main features, the Declaration of Independence is a great spiritual document. It is a declaration not of material, but of spiritual conceptions. Equality, liberty, the rights of man. These are not elements which we can see and touch. They are ideals. They have their source and their roots in the religious convictions." President Coolidge went on to say, "Our forefathers came to certain conclusions and decided upon certain courses of action which have been a great blessing to the world. Before we can understand their conclusions, we must go back and review the course which they followed. We must think the thoughts which they thought. They were intent upon religious worship. While scantily provided with other literature, there was a wide acquaintance with the scriptures. They were a people who came under the influence of a great spiritual development and acquired a great moral power. No other theory is adequate to explain or comprehend the Declaration of Independence. It is the product of the spiritual insight of the people." Now, I want to look at a few examples that back up what President Coolidge said. First, in Matthew 7 and verse 12, Jesus Christ gave a one-verse summary of much of the Bible. He said, "All things whatsoever you would that men should do to you, do you even so to them. For this is the law and the prophets." In other words, a man who's not treating another man as his equal, a fellow man endowed by his Creator with the right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, is not treating that man as he himself would be treated. A man who is oppressing another man is violating God's law. God commands human beings to treat every man, every woman, every child with respect and justice. Treat him as a fellow man made in God's image, as an heir together of the grace of life. And you see this all over the Bible, in the Old Testament and the New Testament. In Galatians 6 and verse 10, the Apostle Paul said, "As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good to all men." 2 Timothy 2 and verse 24, "The servant of the Lord must be gentle unto all men." Hebrews 12 and verse 14, "Follow peace with all men." 1 Peter 2 and verse 17, "Honor all men." And beyond that, God commands over and over to pay special attention to the needy, to the sick and the afflicted, the downtrodden, the poor, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, the blind, the deaf, the lame. God pays special attention to these people, and He wants us to think the way that He does. Now, a lot has been made recently regarding the great sin at the time of America's founding of slavery. Many people depended on it, and they would not let it go. And in the early stages of the next presidential election, around a dozen Democrat candidates support some form of reparations, including Senators Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker. More and more people today are viewing this issue as the dominant reality overshadowing America's entire founding. And that is a terribly perverse way of looking at this nation and its birth. Of course, America has flaws, and it has had from the very beginning, but those flaws don't define this nation. In fact, in America's case, it's much more fair to say the story of this nation is about having overcome some of those initial flaws, as we'll talk about. How would you like to be in a relationship with someone who only saw your flaws, who defined you by your flaws, and they were completely unable to see your qualities and your virtues and your strengths. That's perverse. It's unfair. It's not a relationship you would want to be in. Yet that's how more and more people look at America. But beyond that, even at the time of the founding, as much as people want to dismiss all the founders as racists and slaveholders, there were many of those men who worked very hard to end what had been virtually throughout human history the very common practice of slavery. George Washington, who was a slave owner himself, he said, "There's not a man living who wishes more sincerely than I do to see a plan adopted for the abolition of it." John Adams said, "I have through my whole life held the practice of slavery in abhorrence." James Madison said, "We have seen the mere distinction of color made in the most enlightened period of time a ground of the most oppressive dominion ever exercised by man over man." And John Jay said, "The United States are far from being irreproachable in this respect. It is undoubtedly very inconsistent with their declarations on the subject of human rights to permit a single slave to be found within their jurisdiction." Many of these men never had slaves, and they fought very hard to get rid of slavery. They wrote the Constitution without even mentioning it directly because they wanted that document to be timeless. They wanted it to stand even after slavery was abolished. They knew, many of them, that slavery is a sin. And they knew that because they knew their Bibles. They knew verses like Jeremiah 22 and verse 13, which says, "Woe unto him that builds his house by unrighteousness and his chambers by wrong, that uses his neighbor's service without wages and gives him not for his work." Woe, that verse says. This is going to create major problems. It's going to bring curses. Thomas Jefferson said this in 1784, "Can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated, but with his wrath?" That's an excellent question from Mr. Jefferson. "Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever, that considering numbers, nature, and natural means only, a revolution of the wheel of fortune, an exchange of situation is among possible events, that it may become probable by supernatural interference. The Almighty has no attribute which can take side with us in such a contest." That is how Jefferson felt about slavery. He did own slaves, but he knew it was wrong, and he feared that it would actually bring God's judgment. What a prophetic statement. How much has this nation suffered because of this sin? Certainly, it's a curse to the slave. It's a curse to the one being oppressed. But that's not what Jeremiah said. He said, "Woe to the oppressor, because God will avenge." Many people who do not know their Bibles say that God condoned slavery. It is true that God regulated slavery. He allowed temporary slavery as a means of recovering from poverty, but he never condoned the kind of slavery that happened in this country. He commanded the death penalty for stealing a man. He never condones abuse and tyranny and man ruling over man unjustly. For 6,000 years, he's been allowing man to prove that no race should rule the world. The human race is unfit to rule the world. Only God can rule the world with justice and equity. Colossians 4 and verse 1 says, "Masters, give unto your servants that which is just and equal, knowing that you also have a master in heaven." And even stronger is James 5 and verse 4, which says, "Behold, the hire of the laborers who have reaped down your fields, which is of you, kept back by fraud, cries, and the cries of them which have reaped are entered into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth." Many Bible passages show that God hears the cries of the slave or the individual working without pay. And that Lord of Sabaoth reference, that means the Lord of the armies of Israel. That's saying that God has armies that are saddled up and ready for warfare who will bring justice. Some people came along later, some years after the founding, and they defended slavery as a good. In fact, some even tried to use the Bible as justification for that. None of the founders thought that at the time of the founding. Sadly, the problem got worse. Abraham Lincoln came along and he tried to put a box around it, and he treated it like the evil it was. And he did that by returning again and again and again to those words in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal. Some people tried to say that that didn't apply to blacks. Lincoln said, yes, it does. It is talking about all men. This is what this nation was founded on. He took steps to limit slavery, steps that threatened the southern states, and the southern states seceded. Lincoln almost single-handedly held the country together. And during the Civil War, as a war measure, he passed the Emancipation Proclamation. It was a radical move. It applied to certain states, but not others. But it explicitly made ending slavery a goal of that war. Now, that enraged a lot of people, but it ended up being the basis for freeing over 3 million individuals. And then Lincoln passed the 13th Amendment, which applied to all states throughout the country. Lincoln said this in his second inaugural address on March 1965, after 4 years of civil war that killed 700,000 to 900,000 people, just an incredible nightmare for the country. He quoted Matthew 18 and verse 7. "Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes." Lincoln said, what if slavery was an offense and God has given us, quote, "this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came"? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue, until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. Every American should be inspired by what the founders did, by what Abraham Lincoln did. Slavery was a sin. This nation went through hell to get rid of it. It's true that the problems didn't go away immediately. The woes continued for both sides. We can talk about that in a future program. Suffice it to say that both whites and blacks within America tried to solve the problems and address the wrongs their own way, rather than looking for God's help and for God's solutions. Blacks by resisting the authorities, by civil disobedience and protest. Whites by enforcing social integration and a war on poverty, welfare programs, trying to fix problems caused by weak families through government intervention. And all of these solutions have created more problems. Of course, there's racism in America, just like there is in all nations throughout human history. But the reality is that there is no nation where so many different peoples get along as well as in the United States, even though the left is trying hard to change that. No country in the world is so accepting of minorities as fellow citizens as America. In Germany, if you're a third-generation German of Turkish descent, most Germans still consider you a Turk. In America, if you immigrate from Turkey or Nigeria or China or any other country in the world, you are considered an American. Yes, America has oppressed minorities. We do have some ugly history, but the story of this nation is one of overcoming that history and working to live up to the ideals articulated in our Declaration of Independence. Dinesh D'Souza said, in all the literature condemning Western slavery, few scholars have asked why a practice sanctioned by virtually all people for thousands of years should be questioned and eventually halted by only one. That is the truth. This 4th of July, remember the beautiful revolutionary ideal that shot like a lightning bolt into the annals of the nations. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This past Sunday, history was made when, in an unplanned visit, an American president traveled somewhere that none of his predecessors ever had, a few steps beyond the border into North Korea. We'll learn about this and the possible prophetic ramifications in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
As with many chapters in the Trump presidency, this story begins with a tweet. It was one that the president posted on Saturday morning from Osaka, Japan, where he was attending the G20 meeting. And in this tweet, President Trump said he would be heading to South Korea the next day after leaving Japan, and he wrote, quote, "While there, if Chairman Kim of North Korea sees this, I would meet him at the border/demilitarized zone, just to shake his hand and say hello," end quote. So the demilitarized zone, or the DMZ, is the small strip of land between North and South Korea right on the famous 38th parallel. And it serves as a neutral territory between the two Koreas, because they're technically still at war since no peace treaty has ever been signed between them following the Korean War. Well, President Trump's tweet set off a 24-hour scramble by his officials to prepare for a possible meeting. And then the North Koreans, of course, saw the tweet, and their foreign minister and other officials began to frantically prepare. Normally, months of preparation go into these kinds of meetings, but the very next day after that tweet had been sent, and after some scheduled meetings took place between Trump and South Korea's president, President Trump and Chairman Kim met in the DMZ. They greeted each other like old friends, and they spoke there for several minutes. And then Kim invited Mr. Trump to actually step out of the DMZ and into North Korea. And President Trump accepted this invitation. He crossed the border, and he took about 20 steps into this officially hostile territory. In so doing, Mr. Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to cross the border and enter North Korea. This was historic. Chairman Kim was beaming throughout all of it. The video footage is remarkable. And as President Trump patted him on the back, Kim said, quote, "It's good to see you again. I never expected to meet you in this place," end quote. And that was true for the whole world, really. There was much about this historic meeting and the time they spent together after crossing into the South Korean side that was entirely unexpected. Critics of this decision by President Trump to visit Kim have two main arguments. One is that the visit gives dangerous legitimization to the Kim regime. They say, why would the leader of the free world go meet with this murderous despot in his country and shake his hand in front of all of his people when it will just bolster the narrative that Kim is forcing upon his people, which basically says that he's the most important person on earth? The critics say Trump's decision helps Kim tighten his power over the North Koreans. The only trouble with that line of logic is that Kim has near absolute power in North Korea with or without this meeting. So the fact that he can now play his people endlessly looped video footage showing him shaking hands with the U.S. president doesn't actually change much in terms of his domestic power. Kim is already at maximum legitimacy, so sitting down at the negotiation table doesn't really change much about the grip that he has on power inside North Korea. The other argument frequently made by critics is that this meeting on Sunday was a lot of pomp and pageantry, but no real results. They say this was a good photo op for President Trump and Chairman Kim, but that it doesn't change the fact that Kim has done very little in terms of denuclearizing North Korea. There may well be validity to that argument, but one important development to keep in mind is weapons tests. If we go back to the time before President Trump began his outreach to North Korea, Kim was testing long-range rockets regularly. And he was conducting tests of nuclear weapons with increasing frequency. There were two major nuclear detonations in 2016 and an even more significant one in 2017. But all of that ended in November of 2017. That's when the efforts began for Trump and Kim to negotiate a deal. There have been a few small short-range missile tests that the North conducted since then, but not any of the ones that threaten the U.S. and most of the world. And there have been no nuclear detonations at all. So that's not an insignificant development. That's not a small accomplishment to have those tests that were destabilizing the region and terrifying South Korea and Japan and others come to an end. So we may still be a ways off from denuclearizing North Korea, but the value of that pause in tests is considerable. And it should factor into all assessments of the value of the Trump administration's meeting over the weekend and his other efforts on this front. The main takeaway from the meeting over the weekend is that both sides announced that they would be resuming the stalled nuclear talks starting in another week or so. Parts of those talks could even happen at the White House, which President Trump invited Kim to visit during this trip, and parts of the talks could happen in North Korea's capital of Pyongyang, which Kim invited Trump to visit. The New York Times is normally among President Trump's fiercest critics, but even they had a sanguine view of this outcome of the president's historic visit to North Korea. The Times opined, quote, "In typical Trumpian fashion, the visit was good television, but it has the potential to be something much more significant. It could provide the basis for detailed talks between real negotiators, signifying an important step toward reaching an agreement to address the global threat of North Korea's nuclear program." Skepticism is, of course, warranted. Both sides have zigged and zagged on policy since Trump took office, but there are signs that Mr. Trump and Mr. Kim want a deal. End quote. Among the most notable of these signs is that it seems Kim Jong-un is becoming more interested in developing his country's economy than in developing more weapons of mass destruction. If it's true that Kim wants to prioritize propelling his nation forward on a highway of economic modernization, then he may be willing to make a real compromise and bring about a historic deal. Ultimately, though, the deciding factor in such a decision will be China, and also to a degree, Russia. Back in September, of 2017, when North Korea's weapons test and its belligerent behavior were at a fever pitch, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote in a coworker letter that the world should be far more concerned about China and Russia than about North Korea, because it's China and Russia that enable the Kim regime's duplicity and its belligerence. Mr. Flurry wrote, quote, "The Bible's prophecies show that, in a sense, the North Korea crisis is a massive distraction from the real threat posed by China and Russia. These powerful Asian nations are the only reason North Korea is able to operate so freely, and Bible prophecy shows that they pose a threat many times greater than the one from North Korea." End quote. The prophecies that Mr. Flurry referred to are recorded mainly in Ezekiel 38 and 39, in Daniel 11, and in the book of Revelation. These Bible passages show that in the end time, Russia and China will lead a powerful Asiatic military bloc called in Scripture the Kings of the East. The Bible shows that smaller Asian nations, very likely including North Korea, will be absorbed into that Russian-led bloc and lend their military power to it, but North Korea will not be a lead player. Mr. Flurry's assessment here has been vindicated by the fact that Kim Jong-un has recently held a historic first meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Russia. And Kim has met numerous times in the last couple of years with Chinese President Xi Jinping. The most recent of his visits with Xi came on June 20th and 21st, just a few days before the Trump-Kim summit. There have also been, in the last few days, some major concessions from the Trump administration to China in the trade war that the two nations are in the midst of. The most notable concession was that President Trump has partially ended his targeting of China's tech giant Huawei, and Trump lifted the most injurious parts of a U.S. ban on that company. It's likely that China is working with North Korea behind the scenes, directing the nation to cooperate with the U.S. more in exchange for this relief on China from the U.S. In either case, the fact remains that China and Russia are the main Asian powers that we need to keep carefully watching, and they will use this situation with North Korea to accomplish their long-term objectives. In the August 2018 issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet, senior editor Joel Hilliker wrote about the first meeting between President Trump and Chairman Kim, which occurred in Singapore. He wrote, quote, "This could be the end of the era when North Korea served to provoke and distract America, and the beginning of the era when North Korea integrates into the rest of Asia as China consolidates its power, unifying much of Southeast Asia under its lead. Thus, events that flow from the Singapore summit may well lead to greater peace in the short term. But it could also be a major step toward the fulfillment of the Bible's prophecies of a coming Asian superpower dominated by Russia and China, a superpower that will be a major combatant in the coming nuclear World War III." End quote. In his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Mr. Flurry shows that developments that we're now seeing with Russia, China, North Korea, and beyond show that nuclear World War III is very near. But he also shows that unprecedentedly good news is intimately tied to these developments. He says these prophetic developments, quote, "ultimately lead to the transition from man ruling man to God ruling man. And it's almost here. It's just a few short years away." End quote. These prophecies are being rapidly fulfilled today, and it's amazing to see it all playing out just as it was written in the Bible thousands of years ago. And seeing that God is bringing his prophecies to fulfillment should make us want to understand the Bible and the mind that is accomplishing this. It should stir us to take some action to know God and to escape the destruction that's quickly coming on the world. The Bible makes clear that individuals can be protected, families can be spared from the destruction that is on the horizon. There is a way to be protected and to be there when Christ returns and puts an end to all mankind's violence and his pathetic attempts at ruling himself. And for any listener who would like to understand how to do that, we would love to send you a copy of Mr. Flurry's booklets, The Prophesied Prince of Russia and Isaiah's End Time Vision. These booklets lay these prophecies out plainly and show what it all means in the big picture, and they show what we need to do as a result of understanding these astounding developments.
This is Trumpet Hour.
The Obama administration has been out of power for 2 years, but intelligence and law enforcement officials from that administration continue to exercise remarkable influence to this day, thanks to close relationships they have developed with mass media, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
Barack Obama has changed his retirement plans. When the president thought his successor would be fellow Democrat Hillary Clinton, he joked about playing dominoes with retired talk show host David Letterman. And in 2015, he told a crowd of students that he planned to eventually return to the work of advancing his agenda in local communities. But after Donald Trump's upset victory, Obama has chosen a different profession, the movies. The former president is not the only one from his administration who is now in media. A surprising number of high-level officials, including top spies, now work for technology, media, and news firms. Yet looking back, this shouldn't be surprising. During Obama's 8 years in office, his administration's intelligence community became entwined with the national media to an extent that should shock anyone who believes in free speech. Obama and his spies are working for Netflix, CNN, MSNBC, and other media outlets. They are working to advance the same agenda they advanced when in government: take down Donald Trump, and, as Obama said during his election campaign, fundamentally change America. One of the most shocking, illegal, and treasonous examples of the extremes to which the Obama administration went was the Clinton Steele dossier. In April 2016, a lawyer from Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign hired former British spy Christopher Steele to find damaging information on Donald Trump. Steele worked with Russian agents to write unsubstantiated reports that the Trump campaign worked with Russian agents. The Russians told Steele that the Russian government had given the Trump campaign damaging information against his political opponents. They also told him that the Russian government had blackmail proving Trump was with prostitutes in a Moscow hotel. The FBI used this dossier to obtain a warrant to spy on the Trump campaign, and the Obama administration coordinated the spying to frame Donald Trump with false accusations that his election campaign illegally worked with the Russian government. On January 5th, 2017, an important meeting took place in the White House. Trump had won the election and was about 2 weeks away from being inaugurated. In the Oval Office were President Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, National Security Agency Director Michael Rogers, Central Intelligence Agency Director John Brennan, Federal Bureau of Investigations Director James Comey, National Security Advisor Susan Rice, and Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates. The subject of the discussion, Donald Trump. These politicians, security officials, and spies were literally strategizing how to continue using false accusations to investigate their new boss after he took office. Comey later revealed the strategy suggested by Clapper: inform Trump about the salacious parts, but not that the FBI was investigating him for collusion with Russia. Comey flew to Trump Tower and told the president-elect that CNN had a dossier of rumors about him. But he did not tell him that Clinton's campaign paid for the dossier or that the FBI was investigating him. According to a House Intelligence report, Clapper discussed the dossier with a CNN reporter around the time Comey was briefing the president-elect on the same topic. After this discussion, CNN reported on the meeting between Comey and Trump, and BuzzFeed published the entire 35-page Clinton Steele dossier. Once the media had published the dossier, Clapper resigned on January 20th, 2017, the day Donald Trump took the oath of office. 8 months later, CNN hired Clapper as a national security analyst. Now, in the past, presidents and spies have segued to more ordinary pursuits after their time in office. Not Barack Obama and his national security establishment. They are waging a media war against President Trump. After leaving office, Barack and Michelle Obama signed a deal with the online video giant Netflix. They will be producing anti-Trump documentaries, including an adaptation of Michael Lewis's book, The Fifth Risk, Undoing Democracy, about Trump's failure to appoint qualified people to government positions. Susan Rice, also in that Oval Office meeting, works for Netflix as well, as a member of its board of directors. James Clapper still works as a CNN national security analyst. He is currently condemning Trump for declassifying documents related to the surveillance of his campaign during the 2016 election. He is also spreading the rumor that Trump is encouraging Russia to interfere in the 2020 election. CNN has also hired former CIA Director Michael Hayden, former CIA agent Stephen Hall, former FBI agent Asha Rangappa, former FBI agent James Gagliano, former Deputy National Security Advisor Tony Blinken. Meanwhile, MSNBC has hired former CIA Director John Brennan as a national security analyst. Brennan has also been accused of leaking to the press classified information claiming Russia had meddled in the 2016 election. His goal is to defame and depose President Trump. MSNBC has hired Chuck Rosenberg, former chief of staff for FBI Director James Comey, Frank Figliuzzi, former chief of FBI counterintelligence, Juan Zarate, former deputy national security advisor, and Ken Delanian, the Los Angeles Times reporter who was caught sending drafts of his articles to Obama's CIA for approval before publishing. These former CIA agents, FBI officials, and security bureaucrats have become some of the best-known faces in a new hybrid industry where deep state spies are rebranded as journalists. The fact that the major media is hiring spies and agents from the Obama administration is concerning. Since President Trump took office, the Justice Department has more than tripled the number of investigations into government leaks to the media outlets. Many Obama-era spies and intelligence officials are now working for the very news agencies that publish these leaks. The team of CNN reporters who reported on the January 6, 2017 meeting between FBI Director James Comey and Donald Trump actually won the Meriden Smith Award for Broadcast Journalism at the White House Correspondents Association dinner last year. But this team of reporters only knew about that meeting because the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, leaked the information to them. This type of partnership between spy agencies and the press is routine in third world countries, but it does not bode well for the health of American democracy. Today, people praise the brave CNN reporters who collaborate with spy agencies against a president whom 63 million Americans voted into office. A truly free press prioritizes evidence-based reporting to inform people around the world around them. Almost nothing is worse for democracy than journalists colluding with political operatives and spies to misinform the public. Yet now, the very same spies who tried to rig the 2016 presidential election with lies, innuendo, and conspiracy theorizing actually work for the mainstream media.
thank you very much for that, Andrew. It's such an important subject, and it's interesting when you break it down like that to see this has become absolutely common. Like we're absolutely accustomed to seeing these former intelligence officials appearing on cable news stations, giving their opinions about what the president is up to, the fact that they've had these security clearances, that they've been privy to some of this this information. That's kind of viewed as a positive. They're overlooking the fact that these people in so many cases did unbelievably lawless things for political purposes.
Right. It's amazing how much society's changed in a very short period of time. There was actually a CIA director in the 1950s who, years later after he left office, they'd caught him. He had his agents write up about 400 news articles and then leaked them to the press and had them published as independent journalist pieces. And there's pretty big public outcry in the 1970s when they found out that the CIA was writing people's news. Same things happening today on a much worse level. But not only is there not a public outcry, you're actually having large sections. I mean, I guess that this is a little bit of the media patting itself on the back, but talking about how Donald Trump is the enemy of the media. They said he uses fake news, and it's like, well, President Trump is against the press, and he's against freedom of speech. When in reality, it's these journalists who are colluding with government spy agencies to use rumors that they knew are not true. I mean, all those people I mentioned in that meeting, they knew that dossier of rumors was something that Hillary Clinton paid for, and that it's just based on hearsay. This guy's Christopher Steele's getting from Russia. None of it's verified. None of it's proven.
Right.
They publish it if it's fact. Your journalists work with the FBI and the CIA to spread this propaganda. And then anyone who calls it out, they're like, well, you're against the free press. I'm like, so the press isn't free. The press is this is like the like Pravda from the Soviet Union, where the KGB is working with the media. And now you've got the CIA working with its select media outlets.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to argue with what's happening objectively. It seems like the reason why people are justifying this, or they're thinking that this is okay, is hatred for Donald Trump, therefore ends justify means.
Right. They're thinking that Donald Trump, if you're taking the media narrative at face value, that if Donald Trump is a fascist dictator, then yeah, what wouldn't you do to keep a fascist dictator right from the country?
So this really does, everything that you're describing here, you're talking about Obama-era officials who are leveraging political influence in the media that are going along with them, they're working together in order to achieve common political purposes. We're really seeing what effectively is, if you look at the way that Gerald Fleury has talked about the Obama administration in his booklet, America Under Attack, he talked about President Obama being a type of an Antiochus who is actually working to bring down the country from within. And you see these lawless acts not only being committed by these government officials, but now being endorsed and encouraged and continued by the media in a way that demonstrates that spirit of Antiochus is very much alive.
Right. And as Mr. Fleury points out in that booklet, Antiochus is this—he's this ancient Syrian king mentioned in the Book of Daniel, not by name, but by the description of what he did. He's a tyrannical king who is most famous for pretending he's something he's not. He came across, and his actions was one of the worst tyrants in human history. But in his words, he gained office through flatteries, and he came across as much more moderate than he was. Mr. Fleury makes the comparison to Barack Obama and his administration in the article, who was just a radical left-wing socialist who, when you listen to his speech, kind of comes off as more of a centrist. And the media has that same, you're coming off like you're these courageous, free media journalists defending America from this fascist dictator, when in truth, you're collaborating with this Antiochus figure's spy agencies to spread lies to the American people.
Yeah. Well, I would definitely encourage listeners to go and check out that booklet, America Under Attack by Gerald Fleury. It shows the spiritual dimension to what is happening in America. And what's amazing to me is that booklet was written some years ago, obviously long before Donald Trump came to office. But it revealed this evil spiritual power at play trying to bring America down, and it's still extremely relevant. Even though we've had a change in administration, as you said, the Obama-era officials who are still doing their work in these positions of influence demonstrate just how relevant that still is. So go check that out. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about what has been happening to all of those officials, those Obama-era officials, how they've leveraged their political influence and formed alliances with the media. He's actually written an article about this subject that's going to appear on thetrumpet.com. Yesterday's spies, today's journalists. You can watch for that on the website. And Andrew, thanks again for bringing this to us.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Darkness is descending on the long, historically extraordinary Anglo-American age. Britain, once a globe-girdling empire, is now a third-rate power, marginalized next to a growing European superstate. America, once the greatest superpower on earth, has lost a significant amount of global influence and has many other nations working to undermine it. History teaches that world orders don't last. They come and go. This present one is giving way to something very different, and it truly will be the world's loss. However, Britain and America's brightest days are not history. Glowing within their remarkable past is the promise of a far more luminous future. The British and the Americans have long believed they were duty-bound, even destined, to lead the world. Kirk Emmert wrote in Winston S. Churchill on Empire, "The glory of the British Empire was its service to a cause that transcended Britain, that transcended history, that transcended time itself. That cause," he wrote, "was to lift human life away from barbarism and savagery towards civilization and human excellence." Churchill passionately devoted himself to promoting that empire and considered the fostering of civilization as its highest purpose. He wrote, "Empire civilizes both the ruled and their rulers." The United States founders sought to establish a lasting beacon of liberty and democracy to the nations. Lyman Beecher said that the nation was destined to lead the way in the moral and political emancipation of the world. Abraham Lincoln said America must ensure that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. Since it entered into World War II, the United States has essentially served as the guarantor of peace in the world. All such human efforts are imperfect, but until recently, the fruits of the Anglo-American effort to benefit mankind have been more sweet than bitter. Biblical prophecy reveals there's an awesome reason for this, and it points back to ancient history, and it also illuminates an inspiring future. You can read it in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. The reason is that these nations are the modern descendants of ancient Israel. The Bible shows that Israel was given a great responsibility. God chose this nation to represent him and to set an example for the world. Biblical history and prophecy show that God still intends for Israel's descendants to fulfill this glorious purpose. There's an outstanding example in Jeremiah, which was written for the end time. Chapter 13, verse 11, God describes wearing the nation of Israel like a man wearing a waistcloth or a belt as a handsome ornament. Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry wrote that this is the big overview. God created the tribes, later nations of Israel, for an incredible purpose. They were created to be a praise and a glory to God. The nations of Israel were to cause the whole world to praise and glorify God. This waistband depicted in Jeremiah 13, it was made out of linen, just like the garments of Israel's priests, which were made for glory and for beauty, it says in Exodus. The nation had a priestly calling, which means a responsibility to serve other nations and point them to God. Israel was like a priestly garment worn by God himself. But if you look at that passage in Jeremiah, you see what God was illustrating. God told Jeremiah not to wash the waist belt, even to stick it into a rock beside the river for a time until it was ruined and unusable. This way, God was vividly depicting how Israel failed in its beautiful calling. But if you notice, verses 9 and 10 of that chapter also apply to Israel's modern descendants, nations that God condemns for arrogance, evil, disobedience, self-will, idolatry. They became worthless to God, and God says he's going to dispose of these rebellious nations like a rotten girdle. When John Winthrop spoke of America as a city on a hill in 1630, he issued a warning based on prophecies like this one in Jeremiah. He wrote, "We must consider that we will be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword throughout the world." This is where Britain and America find themselves today. And it's going to get worse. The sun is setting on Anglo-American dominance. And when these nations fall, the world will plunge back into the blackness of barbarism and savagery. However, the Bible that prophesied this fall also prophesies that Britain and America's brightest days are yet to come. Jeremiah 33 depicts a time yet future after America and Britain have endured tribulation intended to correct them for their sins. It contains God's promises to restore prosperity to them and make them a positive example. They will become a praise and an honor before all the nations of the earth, Jeremiah 33 says. God intends to help these nations become the positive example they have always struggled and failed to be. But it won't be Pax Americana or the British Empire they will be promoting, but the peace of God and the kingdom of God. The King of Kings will lift all human life towards civilization and excellence, and Britain and America finally will submit to him and become the beautiful, godly ornaments they were always intended to be. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from John F. Kennedy. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.